From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jim Crow laws gave rise to horrific violence, humiliation, and race-based terror, which makes a new examination of separatism as a means of protecting African American culture all the more provocative. St. Louis University law professor Anders Walker makes the argument that contemporary ideas about diversity came from arguments against integration championed by 20th century white writers and influential black intellectuals. We caught up with him before an event at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library to talk about his book, The Burning House, Jim Crow and the Making of Modern America. I asked him about that title, The Burning House, which is a term that was used both by James Baldwin and William Faulkner. But Baldwin, unlike the NAACP, challenged the idea that assimilation should be the goal for African Americans. So what was Baldwin's argument?
So James Baldwin came from a tradition of very critical thinking about the United States. His family left the South, moved to New York, and he rankled at the idea that the solution to racial injustice in America was to assimilate African Americans into mainstream white society. This was the holding in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. And Baldwin said, wait a minute, why should we want to assimilate into white society? Maybe whites could learn from our history and our traditions. White America's a burning house.
So other African-American writers, Ralph Ellison, Zora Neale Hurston, you quote on the book and write about them in detail, intellectuals and leaders argue that forced integration inspired art, like jazz and blues, and created a resilience and separate folkways among African-Americans. Was that an argument for Jim Crow?
It was. So as early as the 1890s, New South boosters like Henry Grady here in Georgia, Charles Brantley Aycock in North Carolina, argued, and this was the aspirational case for segregation. Sure, it also included disfranchisement and discrimination, but a lot of progressives said this system of separating the races is going to create a diverse society. African Americans and whites will create their own institutions, their own traditions, their own schools, even their own art. And this will enable us to live in harmony, to work closely side by side, but also to preserve our separate identities.
So Henry Grady, you mentioned, argued that African Americans, they didn't need to be absorbed into Anglo-Saxon culture and could develop their own. Was this an idea of just bicultural parallel societies living side by side?
It was. And it was a right-hand turn away from what had been going on in the South before the Civil War. Before the Civil War, the aspirational case for the legal system of slavery had been, we are assimilating people from other backgrounds that are non-Christian into Christian Anglo-Saxon white society. We're helping slaves. We're caring for them. And there was this humanitarian project, as Southern proponents of slavery explained it. After the war, a new theory comes up, and that is, we don't want assimilation. We want separate development. We want to create separate traditions, separate institutions, and a separate society, and that will actually minimize violence rather than increase it.
Right, and this was an argument made by Robert Penn Warren that the cultural strength of the South was proof that it needed to reform the Jim Crow system as opposed to this wholesale revolution of it. But this was also a man who, you know, gathered Negro folk songs and tales and appreciated black folk ways and thought they needed to be protected. But is that paternalism, like this idea of the happy Negroes working on the plantation?
Sure. So this whole story can fit into a larger literature on the South, and it can be viewed as a form of paternalism, which is we are going to treat different people differently because we know best. Now, Warren turned to African-American folklore and wrote an essay in 1929 called The Briar Patch, where he said, African Americans in the South are like Brer Rabbit. And in the folklore or the folk story, Brer Rabbit is captured by a fox, who in Warren's telling are whites. And he says to the fox, whatever you do, don't throw me into the briar patch. Mm. And the briar patch appears to be hostile and dangerous. It's full of thorns. And the fox says, okay, that's exactly what I'm going to do. He throws Brer Rabbit into the briar patch, and Brer Rabbit escapes. Why? He'd grown up in the briar patch. And so Warren saw it as a black space. And here's the irony. We've come full circle. So the platform, the movement for Black Lives, Black Lives Matter, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who riffs on James Baldwin and the Burning House, tells a similar story, which is we don't necessarily want integration. There's almost no mention of integration in the movement for Black Lives. It's about Black institutions, Black traditions, and Black history, a Black narrative of what this country is about. And so, yes, there's a facet to this that is paternalist, but then there's another facet to it that's almost nationalist in a way. And so it cuts in a lot of different directions.
Robert Penn Warren was also part of this group called the Fugitives, and they were trying to distinguish themselves from Northerners, from the mass industrial culture that was then overtaking the North. So how much of this idea of bicultural institutions is also resistance to Northern norms or to the government telling them what to do, as happened with Brown versus Board of Education?
Well, that's what's interesting about the Civil War. So the Civil War leaves Southerners, white Southerners in particular, with a real distaste for federal government, a real distaste for the idea of centralized control. And so a type of conservatism emerges, and this conservatism is anti-government. And this is what Lewis Powell, the Supreme Court Justice, talks about in Regents versus Bakke, which is a disaggregated landscape where America is a land of plural institutions, plural views. And that's important. We have to retain that because otherwise we're all going to be doing what the government tells us to do. And they're responding to what the Union Army did during the Civil War, to Reconstruction. And there's an African-American corollary to this that today we see in the opinions of Clarence Thomas, who comes from Pinpoint, Georgia, a place where General Sherman had promised African-Americans land. Andrew Johnson, president, reneges on that. He sends Oliver Otis Howard down to Georgia to tell freed people, you don't get land. And that then breeds resentment against government in African-American communities. And so there's this sense that we want our own local institutions and traditions, and we don't want the government forcing us all to be the same. And in the 20th century, the big example that everyone wheels out is the Soviet Union.
But that argument for states' rights, for law and order, championed by Powell and people like Clarence Thomas, has become, or has it become, code for racism?
Well, that's how most historians of the 20th century South read it, unless you focus on diversity. And diversity, when Powell says diversity is a compelling interest in 1978 in Regents versus Bakke, everyone on the court startled. What could he possibly mean? A compelling interest is generally national security, protection of life. But Powell doubles down on this longstanding view in the South that we're all about pluralism. We're not about ethnic white nationalism. We're not about creating a society where no one was different. We believe in difference. And if diversity comes from the South, then we've got to rethink the last 50 years of liberal thinking in the United States, because diversity is now one of our highest ideals. It's transformed higher education. It's transformed corporate America. And all kinds of folks are interested in diversity. Is it possible that this is a positive legacy that comes from the South?
Well, I think of Zora Neale Hurston, who you quote in the book, says, how much satisfaction can I get from a court order for somebody to associate with me who does not wish to be near me? But where does this idea of parallel, diverse coexistences end? I mean, it's one thing to play the blues at a juke joint. It's another to insist that you have the right to vote, right? Didn't separate but equal give some permission for and even inspire brutality to keep people in distinct places?
Absolutely. And so many of these intellectuals, and Lewis Powell included, Robert Penn Warren, William Faulkner, they all understood that de jure segregation, mandatory segregation, the humiliating aspects of Jim Crow, the underfunded public accommodations for African Americans, the separate water fountains, the separate restrooms, the seats on the back of the bus, all of that should go. That's fine. But they said, but we should leave space for people to preserve their traditions and their histories. It's a case in many ways for Black studies. And ironically, that then becomes much more popular in the 80s and 90s. And people forget, well, it's this Southern guy from Richmond who came up with this idea.
Well, were these just the elites, however? You know, the Supreme Court justices and the intellectuals? This was not on the mind necessarily of your average civil rights marcher or your rural farmer in the South, was it?
Well, for whites, this was definitely an elite point of view. These are folks who were educated, well-read, And for the most part, they relied on African Americans to run their businesses, to maintain their properties, to maintain their homes. They had very little racial animus. They viewed African Americans as hardworking, responsible, professional, an integral part of Southern society. And that's the reason the book focuses on writers, because it's writers and artists who are most interested in culture. And these folks also happen to be the most educated and also the most traveled. So Faulkner, Warren, Welty, they're all dealing with editors and publishers in New York City, and they're trying to explain this is what life is like.
I'm speaking with Anders Walker. He's the author of the new book, The Burning House, Jim Crow and the Making of Modern America. It applies an absolutely new lens to biculturalism as a founding principle of American race relations and its applications for today. Well, the fear, of course, then was homogeneity, you know, that we would be a cultural beige if the black and the white races all blended together. And this was coming from, you know, the James Baldwin and the Ralph Ellisons and Alice Walkers, as well as Southern segregationists. But looking back now, you know, at urban neighborhoods that have been hollowed out after integration and places where black culture and economies once thrived have now disintegrated. Would those who argued against integration point those out as a result of these policies, or would it be racism?
Well, Justice Powell actually did. He said he filed a brief in the Charlotte versus Mecklenburg County case and said, we need to be very careful about forced integration, busing, aggressive measures. Better to just leave local communities, including local school districts, to do what they're going to do. He agreed we need to do away with explicit racial classifications. You can't exclude students based on race. Otherwise, just let communities evolve. And if you let them evolve in places like Charlotte and Richmond, then the white folks will stay. And so a lot of people thought, well, that's not going to work. We want full integration. We want the full weight of the federal government behind it. But then what happens is people leave. People abandon the cities. We have resegregation. And then we have what Justice Douglas says, we have an even worse scenario. We have segregation and exclusion. African Americans are now isolated. They're not working. They're not integrated into the economies in these cities. And Powell, in many ways, warned that this might happen. And in a lot of ways, it did.
So is this an argument, or is this look at history a way of reexamining culture or law?
I think both. I think one of the hooks here is that the only way to really understand this opinion, Regents versus Bakke, is to look at the story, to look at where Powell came from. And then there is this legal implication that's very relevant today, the lawsuit against Harvard. Mm-hmm. Asian Americans filing suit that they're being discriminated against. And in Powell's view, although this has been misread by many, Harvard can do what it wants. It can discriminate so long as it has a legitimate pedagogical reason. It really wants to bring in students of different perspectives, different views. And if in Harvard's mind, that includes race, that's fine.
You pointed out Ta-Nehisi Coates, among others, has talked about the need for racially autonomous spaces, you know, for safety and for liberation. These were early 20th century intellectuals or mid-20th century intellectuals writing at a time when hip-hop or Michael Jordan or Colin Powell were virtually unimaginable. So what does this reexamination of that time tell us today?
Well, I think it forces us to tell a different story about American history. In a lot of ways, the South saves America. In the 1920s, the United States was going down a very dark road. We were trying to create or support an Anglo-Saxon Protestant society. There was this basic view that the American stock was Anglo-Saxon Protestant Northern European. Max Weber's Protestant work ethic and the spirit of capitalism convinced people that America as a capitalist country was successful precisely because Anglo-Saxon Protestants had built it. We enact strict immigration restrictions to keep out immigrants from Southern and Central Europe, many of whom were Catholic. We enact prohibition to assimilate Catholic immigrants into Protestant society to quash drinking cultures. We support eugenics. Most states had forced sterilization rules for people who are feeble-minded. So Justice Holmes, in his famous statement, three generations of imbeciles are enough, supports this idea of forced sterilization. All of these things were pushing us towards a road where we were embracing genetics, immigration restrictions, creating a kind of racialized nation, so much so that the Germans started taking notes from us in the 1920s and 30s. Adolf Hitler, in his memoir, My Struggler, Mein Kampf, talks about the United States as an Aryan nation. It had used immigration law to keep the United States Northern European. It had removed all indigenous people, i.e. Native Americans. He then appoints lawyers to study American law. They like the mandatory sterilization laws. They like the immigration restrictions. They like bans on interracial marriage. But the one thing they reject is segregation. They say segregation is not going to work for us. It's not going to enable us to create an Aryan state, because that'll mean that minorities, Jewish Germans, will have their own institutions, their own traditions, their own society, and they'll undermine what we're trying to do. In a way, that's what happens. African Americans successfully, by the end of World War II, not only endure Jim Crow, they then prevail. They emerge some of the most eloquent exponents of American ideals. But those ideals mention nothing about Anglo-Saxon Protestant supremacy. They're ideals about equality, racial justice, opportunity, democracy. And if we think of America and American history through this lens, then the South, thanks in part to Jim Crow, but also to the African-American experience, really tells an ascendant, hopeful story.
My guest is Andres Walker, whose book, The Burning House, details arguments made by Black and white intellectuals of the mid-20th century to protect separate cultural traditions and folkways, which for African Americans meant the blues, like we're listening to now. When we come back, how those notions of preserving heritage are being distorted in today's South. I'm Virginia Prescott with On Second Thought, and returning to my conversation with Andres Walker, author of The Burning House, Jim Crow and the Making of Modern America. Walker is a legal scholar, but his book points to arguments made by writers and intellectuals in the mid-20th century against integration. Now, these notions read as offensive and flatly racist, but Walker proposes that by excavating them and putting them in historic context, it reveals more about the roots of pluralism embedded in American culture and eventually law. Well, he's got to prove that to me. Before the break, we talked about the gulf between concepts of coexistence championed by white Southern writers like Robert Penn Warren, who wanted to protect their once dominant culture, and Black intellectuals like James Baldwin and Zora Neale Hurston, who sought a level of separatism that would protect their culture, a culture that had been violently suppressed. So back to Andres Walker. Andres, then how does this idea of preserving cultural identities figure into the current debate over Confederate monuments, for example, the idea that many of them, as we know, were built during the Civil Rights Movement in opposition to the Civil Rights Movement as symbols of cultural heritage, yet a lot of people, contemporary Southerners, hold on to them as symbols of their cultural heritage?
Well, instead of statues of Robert E. Lee, I think we should have statues of my book. And I think that aspect of Southern history is something that the South can double down on. And I think that's something we should commemorate. And I think Confederate statues, if they're contextualized correctly, are important historical markers, precisely because they emerged much later than the Civil War, 1910s, 1920s. And in a weird way, if you think about it, to commemorate Civil War leaders in the 1920s was a middle finger not just at civil rights activists, but at the federal government. So I think that we should rethink Southern history, and I think this tradition of diversity is something positive. I think we should abandon the idea and actually reject the idea that the South had anything to do with the kind of ethnic nationalism that was going on in Europe.
How then did pluralism and multiculturalism become associated with Northern liberals? I mean, even cosmopolitanism or sophistication among the North. So what does that mean for the division of Northern and Southern culture?
So the way most people think of multiculturalism and diversity is that these are ways to achieve integration. These are ways to kind of achieve a plural society. And that tradition as far as I can tell, really comes from other places. Canada is one. So Canada began to develop a discourse of multiculturalism to deal with the French threat of secession. And so Canada began to talk about a different kind of society, a pluralist society that was also about equality. Now, the one thing that Lewis F. Powell Jr. does not do is talk about equality. And in a string of opinions, he really shuts the door on things like affirmative action, reparations, aggressive measures to achieve racial balance in schools. He strikes down busing across school district lines. And in that sense, that's a Southern legacy, which is yes on diversity, but no on government programs to achieve equality. And that we could say is a negative, but the thing is, Powell writes the big opinion. So he's really the source.
And this is a slice of history that a lot of people don't know about. No matter where you live, you learn about the civil rights movement, at least in some broad outlines, and the idea that America is supposed to be integrated and assimilated. Because of that, have you had any backlash from presenting this whole other point of view in this book?
Well, I expected some backlash. I expected people to say, wait a minute, are you saying that Brown was wrong? This was the greatest decision of the 20th century. And in fact, people have been open to my argument, and I think it's because millennials, younger Americans, are over the moment where we believed full assimilation into mainstream white society was the way to go. And I think now, of all times, not just due to Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives, but the Trump presidency. This is a low point for white folks in this country. The Trump presidency is confirming many of the fears that many people had that white people in America are nativists, they're anti-immigrant, they're fearful of integration, they're fearful of new ideas. And if you look at the contrast between the Obama presidency and the Trump presidency, the Obama presidency seems to be more aspirational, more laudable and forward-looking and less riddled with fear and paranoia. And in a weird way, I think folks like Ta-Nehisi Coates have responded to this and said, white America is a burning house. We need to think more carefully about whether we want to integrate into it.
That idea that American culture is being sullied by or diluted by outsiders, by immigrants from, you know, from Eastern Europe, from Mexico, from Central America, is prevailing. That's a movement that is holding on to one's Southern traditions or American traditions. Doesn't that bump up against what you're talking about?
It does. So I think my book says, if you really think about the American South, diversity is a core American value. And so people like Richard Spencer, who allegedly coined the term alt-right, he was one of the organizers of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, he has said publicly, diversity is ruining America. We need to double down on our European heritage. Well, what happened to Europe in the 20th century? It committed suicide twice, first in World War I, then in World War II, over what? European heritage, ethnic nationalism, Aryan supremacy. What did the United States do? We developed segregation. And what happened? Martin Luther King Jr. emerges after World War II, along with A. Philip Randolph and other folks, saying America's about equality, diversity, inclusion, opportunity. And the whole world gets on board with this. And so that aspect of the story, I think, is what we should recover precisely now when people are saying, oh, diversity is not an American value. Oh, it is an American value. And if you want to celebrate Robert E. Lee, that's the value to celebrate.
St. Louis University law professor Anders Walker. His new book, The Burning House, Jim Crow, and the Making of Modern America, details arguments against integration by black and white intellectuals like James Baldwin, who worried about losing heritage forged through slavery, and Jim Crow, like the blues. And we'll leave you with one of Baldwin's favorite musicians, Ray Charles. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Local artist Adron sang her Atlanta swan song last month. After three albums, an EP, and spending most of her life in Georgia, the singer-songwriter has relocated to Los Angeles. But before packing up her guitar and signature whistle, Adron released a brand new album, and she joined us in studio just before her move to talk about water music. Adron, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And you brought your guitar.
I did indeed.
I'm excited about that for proof. Well, congratulations on the new record. To me, it feels like that perfect kind of summery soundtrack. It's kind of sunny and breezy and splashy,
yes.
Which I guess is what water music should be.
Splashy. So I like that, yes.
What were you going for?
I wanted to create a feeling of the kind of like mid to late 1970s studio culture, which is an era of music that I'm very, very deeply into. Those sounds are just so crisp and delicious, but just a little bit dusty, but with all these virtuosic players. And I'm thinking of albums like Joni Mitchell's Court and Spark, mm-hmm. things like that. Not like you love your I wanted to kind of create a feeling of that kind of studio culture that's just like these ambitious compositions, but really deliberately and lushly rendered, but not so much so that you just feel like overwhelmed with pretension or something. It's like trying to just create lush environments for me, really, with sound. And also at the same time, I'm evoking the ocean and equatorial places.
The images of the sea are really, they're woven throughout.
I've never lived near a body or near an ocean, actually. So all of it is like kind of fantasy for me and just sort of evoking like a fantasy island kind of vibe.
That's a good 70s reference as well. Was that 70s or 80s?
Oh, I don't even know. Actually, I'm too young to even know what I just said.
Fantasy Island was this program, you know, it was like where it was your fantasies could come true.
Oh my gosh.
And you flew in by plane. Guest stars flew in every week and were greeted by Ricardo Montalban. And I can't remember the name of the man who played with him, but he would say, "Welcome to Fantasy Island."
Oh, that sounds deliciously cheesy.
It was really cheesy. But let's hear something that's not. The first song in the album is called Be Like the Sea. A little clip from Be Like the Sea from my guest Adron, and the album is called Water Music. And that sounds like, I don't know, I was thinking Maria Muldaur, Midnight
My Mother Oasis. Said the same exact thing. That's
well,
so
because
funny.
We're old, Adron. That's what happens. But the lyrics there, I vote for total upheaval for generous people, for niceness is so profound.
That's what I said.
Yeah, well, at the beginning of this year, you told Bullet Magazine that last year was a pretty crummy year for you.
It was challenging, I would say.
So this feels like you're going to swim beyond that cruddiness or in favor of lightheartedness and generosity and niceness.
Yeah, and it feels like it's in the works right now. By the time this piece airs, my life will be in total upheaval. I will have just moved to Los Angeles. I'll be in a very different state of mind. Right now, I'm kind of just like plugging away, trying to put all the pieces together to make that happen. That's kind of been my year so far. So I was a little unpleasant to be around for a couple months just recently, just like a little stress ball trying to make everything happen for the album's release. But I'm ready to kind of dive back into the original feeling of what the music is about for me, which is just kind of just like transcendent and almost rebellious joy is kind of what I'm going for.
Rebellious joy. I really like that.
Yeah.
So in other words, like rejecting all of the stuff that's kind of bringing you down.
Yeah. Rejecting crap, you know.
You are most associated, especially, I guess, with your last album, with Tropicália music. This is a Brazilian genre of music, and it's always somewhere where you're described, I've noticed.
Yeah.
So let's hear. This is a classic Tropicália song, giving our listeners a little bit more of an idea of that genre. Eu vou por entre fotos e nomes. That is Caetano Veloso singing Alegria, Alegria. And on the more rockin' end of the spectrum of Tropicália music, there is this. This is Os Mutantes, the band that you first were introduced to with Brazilian music?
Yeah, I would say that that particular song was the catalyst for me. That was kind of the occasion for like the supernova that it occurred in my mind and heart when I discovered Tropicália and Brazilian music in general.
This is called A Minha Menina, which is My Girl by Os Mutantes.
Yeah, so Os Mutantes was a massively influential band for me. I heard that song for the first time when I was like 13 or 14. I had just picked up a guitar for the first time like a year prior. I obviously knew I wanted to write songs and be something with regard to that. I hadn't really figured out what it was going to be like. But as soon as that music hit me, I became obsessed, and it completely influenced the way I started to learn guitar.
I'm wondering how you learned that song. I mean, you heard that song when you were 13.
I heard that song actually in the background of a documentary on VH1 or something that was about Beck, who I was obsessed with at the time. And I heard just like a clip of that, and I was like, what the heck is that? And then just sort of like by a kismet, encountered it again when I was just digging for eclectic weird stuff at a record store.
Was that a habit, digging for eclectic weird stuff at record stores?
Kinda. I remember on that particular day I went into Wux Tree Records in Decatur, Georgia. Still a very beloved record store for me. And
was
just
me.
Like, yeah, just with this intention of finding something that would like seem like a really cool obscure reference for me to drop in the future. You know, I'm a teenager and trying to cultivate, I don't know, hip personality.
That's a musician, Adrian, who through the magic of radio is with us now. But when you hear this, she will be living in Los Angeles. She is actually going to come back to Atlanta next month on tour for her new album, which is called Water Music. Well, a couple of years ago, Os Mutantes, that band, performed at the Earl, and you got to perform with them. How
yes.
did that? How did that come together?
That was maybe one of the very coolest things that's happened to me in my life. I have a great relationship with the Earl. They have always been very kind to me over the years. And I just sort of begged them. I was like, can I please open for Os Mutantes? And they were like, yeah, that makes sense. Was kind of the answer. So that happened. And what came of it was the original founding member who was in that version of the band, Sergio Diaz, listened to my whole set. He reportedly cried during my set in front of the sound engineer as they enjoyed my music. And then he brought me up on stage for their encore song, which was one of the first songs by them I'd ever heard, Panisis Oxensis. And I like wept on stage while singing it with them. And it was triumphant, beautiful moment. After that, we stayed in touch, and he actually asked me to join the band.
Wow.
And I was, oh my God, it was so insane. I was getting like my visa ready to go to Brazil and rehearse with them. And it would have been my first time going to Brazil ever as a member of my favorite band of all time. And then unfortunately it just kind of fell apart. Their tour plans just didn't materialize the way they were supposed to. And that plan just kind of dissolved, sadly.
But you still had your cry fest on stage at the Earl.
Mm-hmm.
Both of you.
Yeah, and I got to know that Os Mutantes thought of me in that way as kind of a member of the family, and that, I don't know, it's just something I'll treasure forever.
That's beautiful. And you do sing in Portuguese, or at least you did on your last record. Not on this one, so why not?
It's sort of just happenstance, but I often do write and sing in Portuguese. I like to think of the language as sort of another instrument. But as it happened with the songs on this record, a lot of my headspace was more in kind of American soul music from the 70s and 80s. And also, I'm drifting more these days towards composing with an intention to be more just sort of directly communicative with my audience. And most of my audience is still, at this point, English-speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of working a little bit harder on, like, the stories and what am I telling you and does it matter to you and things like that. But there is a song on the new record that's in French.
It's called Ma Mère.
Yes.
My Ocean?
Yeah, also my mother.
Your
mother. Because the word mère
can
mean either one depending on how you spell it.
Yeah.
So it's a love letter to the ocean.
Well,
I'm wondering if you, if there's a kind of a different version of yourself, you, as singer, songwriter, or person, in each of those languages. Can you inhabit something else in another language?
Yeah, actually, sometimes I use it to like disguise a little bit. Like if I'm writing about something that's, I don't know, that I'm just not really ready to tell you in English, I can kind of have a little secret that no one who knows me will really, you know, decipher. Like, especially there are a couple of really sad songs that I've written, and I don't really like to be publicly sad. I feel like it gives too much power to the thing that hurts. And I kind of stand by that, even though I know it's not what, like, a yoga teacher would tell me to do, but...
They would say to be vulnerable, yeah, and connect with the human side.
And I feel like I'm doing my version of that. But then I have a couple of songs that are in Portuguese that are about something just really personal and really sad. And it helps me record it and remember it. And if you care enough, you can, you know, decipher it and share that experience with me. But it still kind of belongs to me in a way.
So there's a little bit of a mask there. I mean, yeah. I mean, in the artistic sense, I'm not saying that you're being phony or anything like that, which gets cast aside. And your new record, Water Music. The first single you released from the Water Music album is called Your Habitat. Could you play Your Habitat for us?
I would love to. Makes a pocket in time. I go there in my mind when I'm not with you. I could hide out in the closet, or I could lie in the bed. There are a lot of things here to do. Just pretend it's the 70s and we've been in love all along. You could pretend it's the 70s. You could pretend you're in love with me. And maybe then you'll feel differently. And maybe then you'll feel intimately. I'm yours and you're humble.
That's a song, Your Habitat, performed here in the GPB studio by Adron. It's from her record called Water Music. I love that bit. And if you have trouble believing in the sentiment of this song, you could pretend it's the 70s.
Yep.
So that calls to mind for me a sort of slightly faded film clips of couples walking along over bridges where the leaves fall down and onto the water. What is it about,
like,
that?
Intro credits, you know, that Cooper Bold font.
Definitely.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah. Some bell bottoms in there somewhere.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. What is it about the 70s that evokes that? Is it that sort of California sound of music?
Maybe. I feel like to me there's a embrace of the sentimental in that era that I relate to.
Yeah, we got a little bit jaded about sentimentality after that.
For sure, yeah. And I feel like it's starting to come back a little bit. I feel like the kind of the craze for like distanced irony of the 90s and 2000s is like just starting to dissipate a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of my friends are into some like very, very earnest, you know, on the sleeve music nowadays, which is refreshing.
Well, beyond the singing, I hear that Joni Mitchell phrasing a little bit in there. You said you were really, Court and Spark was a big record
big
for
deal,
you.
Big deal, yes.
Beyond the singing, though, you make a lot of sounds. You didn't in this one, but whistle, that sounds less human and more like a tropical bird. How did you discover your talent for whistling?
Great question. I have no idea. I cannot remember starting to do that. I will offer that I'm just sort of a person who habitually emits sounds all the time. whether you're just like in the car or in the shower, I'm just sort of like screwing around with just like sounds all the time. So I have quite a few like weird little parlor tricks up my sleeve, but whistling is one of my favorites. And I don't know, maybe in my teens, I just started doing it all the time.
Can you whistle on command? Would you whistle
a little? Sure.
You're a really good whistler.
Thank you.
You and Andrew Bird, you know, the musician Andrew Bird, you must know.
Oh, yeah.
He's a fantastic whistler.
I'm aware. I've actually publicly offered to battle him in a whistling duel, and that offer stands. But we'll see if he takes me up on it.
Be warned, Andrew Bird. This could happen. So when this conversation does air, we mentioned you're going to be in Los Angeles. And your music is, I think, nostalgic for another era in many ways, and for Brazilian music from the late 1960s. Do you think you'll feel nostalgic for Atlanta?
Absolutely. Yeah, I love Atlanta very much. And it's bittersweet tearing myself away from it because Atlanta has been so good to me and shown me so much support during my time here. And I'm going to miss, you know, the muggy humidity and the cicadas and, you know, all these things that feel so Atlanta to me. But it feels like it's time to start a new adventure, and I definitely get the wanderlust every few years pretty hard. But I'll be back quite often.
Yeah, I know you're going to be at the City Winery. You're going to have maybe another gig in Alpharetta in, what, October, I think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm working on a tour in October that's going to start out of Atlanta. And on the 3rd of October, I'm opening for my dear friend Lyra Lynn at the City Winery in Atlanta. So I highly recommend everybody come out to that.
So this is a very big move for you. I mean, I'm sure there's career involved in this, as you said, some wanderlust. Is it scary?
It's a little scary. It's not as scary as the whole, like, last summer and spring have been. It's not as scary as putting out a brand new record. So right now I'm kind of riding a sense of relief that this process is over. And now I just get to go and, you know, zoom across the country and experience something completely amazing and completely new. So I'm feeling very positive, very optimistic.
This makes me think of Woody Guthrie's song, Going Where the Climate Suits My Clothes. I think you're going to Los Angeles where the climate suits your music.
Yeah, I agree. And here's hoping.
Well, before you go, there is a bonus track you are thinking about releasing later on, and it's called Water Music, which is the title of the record. Would you mind playing it for us?
I would love to.
And I want to thank you so much for joining us and wish you the absolute best in Los Angeles.
Thank you so much for having me.
I woke from a dream where the sea drew back its shore. I was so sure after a while it had taken back all the water. The husbands and wives tried to turn the deadly tide. Land was so dry, animals died from the sudden lack of the water. Just a prayer to the wind and air that will bring us back all the water. Not once in my life have my eyes seen such a sight, quite like the white tumbling kite of the rising waves of the water. Thank you. dream where the sea gave back its shore. I was so sure after a while it had given back all the water.
Is now Los Angeles-based and until very recently Atlanta-based musician Adron. Her new album Water Music is out now, and you can find more about her and her music and her upcoming tour back in Atlanta at gpbnews.org.